the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, we're hearing a lot about a new variant of the COVID virus, Omicron. What does this mean? What will policies be? And what implications are for you, your safety, and the economy? Joining me from Peak Prosperity is Chris Martinson. And Chris, before we begin, I want to talk about something that we're all dealing with now, and that is the news. We have what I call retail news, where the media comes up with this narrative that they spin, and that's the story du jour for the day or the week, depending on the topic. And then there's something called the real story. I want to begin with that because there's almost like two narratives taking place at the same time, one that's being spun and one that is actually happening.
Well, let's go there. Jim, it's good to be back with you. We always had such fun in our interviews back in the day. And this is such a huge effort for me. So as your listeners may or may not know, I've spent a lot of the last 2 years covering COVID, and my science background gave me some good insights into how to cover that. And over time, I realized, actually pretty quickly, that this wasn't about COVID. There's a science. There's a lot of science. There's a lot of interesting stuff. We learned some amazing things about health and how viruses work. I got a whole story there. And the bigger story is about how the narrative got spun around this. And now in my world, the narrative has actually got more energy, and it's something that possibly has more damaging impact on our lives. And the keepers of that, of course, is the media. And they've done, Jim, the most spectacularly awful job of spinning this new narrative. And we can all debate about what the agenda is behind that, but I can tell you for a fact, they are flat out lying to people and misrepresenting things and committing sins of commission, where they flat out lie, and sins of omission, where they just don't tell you about stuff. And that's the world we live in right now.
You know, the amazing thing about it, Chris, maybe we can take this a step further. I mean, every year we lost between 40, 50, 60,000 people a year to the flu virus. And, you know, every year people got flu vaccines. But for the most part, Chris, you know, most people, 99% or more, survive flu. Do you know what the statistic is on COVID? Isn't it like 90%, 99% or more?
Well, yes, and it's age stratified. So if you're under the age of 60, your chance of surviving this without any help whatsoever is about 99.98%. That it's really high survival. And that's actually using old statistics starting from the beginning of this. Because when it first came out, when we first had that first alpha variant breaks out of the lab in Wuhan, that's my position, but it came from Wuhan, that was actually a pretty bad beast, and it was hitting people. But surprisingly, it wasn't hitting kids, wasn't hitting very young people. We didn't know a lot about it. So the first thing we did was we put people on ventilators. Then we gave them remdesivir. Both of those we know now actually are bad things to do. They don't work. In fact, they harm people. So given the treatments we have now, and there are lots of brave doctors who've run into a pharmaceutical buzzsaw and a media buzzsaw. But Jim, I personally know and have talked to doctors who collectively have treated close to 30,000 people. If they can get them within the first 7 days of symptom onset, five is better, earlier the better, they have zero deaths in those age groups, across all age groups. I mean, it's like really a very, very survivable thing. So from a risk-adjusted, humans-facing-threats kind of a standpoint, COVID would not even be a blip on somebody's radar in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And now suddenly, it's such a bad, horrible thing that we're going to take away freedoms and force you to do all kinds of funkadoodle things, like to kids in schools and things like that. So it's a crazy story. That's why we have to get the narrative right. We have this narrative. People are terrified of it. They have it, Jim, they have it so bad. I talk to people. They think that if you catch COVID, you have like a 50% chance of dying, right? It's not even remotely correct. Other people think you have a 30% chance of going to the hospital. Not even remotely correct. And that's without early treatment. And if we have early treatment put into the mix, those numbers drop to really ones that shouldn't cause any healthy culture to have even anything other than what I would call moderate concern.
You know, Chris, I want to talk about the vaccine in early treatment, because we know, for example, things like ivermectin, we know hydroxy work. Chris, I had COVID. And prior to getting COVID, I had contact with a doctor, part of the frontline doctors, that I had ivermectin and hydroxy. I had it in my home. So when I did get COVID, my doctor said immediately, go on the therapeutics. And, you know, I'm 71. So I'm in that category that is basically subject to higher risk from COVID because of age. But Chris, I had it, got through it. You know, I got a little tired and fatigued, but I got through it. Why do you think they have basically downplayed ivermectin and hydroxy? My own view is you couldn't have get the emergency authorization for this vaccine if there was a known treatment like ivermectin and hydroxy. And when I read Robert Kennedy's book, they went to great lengths to discredit it.
Not just to great lengths, but they actually designed trials when they finally ran them to fail. And when these trials failed, Jim, people died. So you decide what language you want to put around that. I've got pretty strong criminal language that I would apply to that. But this was not just the EUA is the emergency use authorization is, yes, that was a feature in why they, whoever they are, didn't want to have any competing things because the emergency use authorization for the vaccine requires that there's no other useful or acceptable treatment that's available at that point in time. So that would have confused that story a little bit. So they didn't want any confusion. They just wanted the vaccine rollout. So I get it. That makes business sense, but the regulators shouldn't have fallen for that. I understand why Pfizer and Moderna want to do that, but the FDA and the CDC, shame on them in this particular story because we knew that there were things that worked and we still know they work. And so that was part one. Part two is goes a little deeper than that. I actually think that ivermectin is what we might call a stone cold category killer, not just for the potential vaccines, but I think other pharmaceutical products because it's really got incredible antiviral capabilities. So we know that now, and now we understand the different receptors, and we've all heard about the ACE2 receptor and the spike protein, but there are this other class of receptors that we know ivermectin actually works at blocking this thing, this virus from getting into the cells through this other class called CD147. So it's over there. That's why azithromycin works too, has some signal in here. That's why melatonin has a signal. All these things that these brilliant clinical observational doctors were noticing, right? Because that's how medicine should happen. Doctors see 1,000 people, they come in and they notice, hey, these 100, they just had the sniffles. Is there anything in their patient records? And they look through and they go, oh my gosh, these people were all on statins or they were taking vitamin D, or they notice those signals. And in a healthy culture, the CDC would have been out there gathering those signals and promoting all of this. So I can make this real simple for all your listeners. If we had a healthy culture that had any interest in our health, and our health authorities had any interest in our health, you and I and everybody listening to this would have heard about vitamin D well over 18 months ago in this story, because that's when we first had our signal that said, wow, people with healthy serum levels of vitamin D get not just a lot less sick, but in many cases, they don't get sick at all. And so a healthy culture, we would have noticed that. It's all you would have heard about. And they would have been promoting that. And Jim, I would have a completely different frame in my mind about what the nature of the story is if they said, listen, we have these vaccines, they're new, we're going to learn some things about them. We think people should take them, especially in risk categories, higher age, more comorbidities, absolutely. And let us tell you about vitamin D and these other early treatments and getting sunshine and moderate exercise and not being stressed out and, you know, maintaining your social contacts and getting a good night's rest. If it was an and, I would feel differently. But Jim, they excluded all of that stuff. I never heard anything about exercise, diet, body weight, vitamin D, these early treatments, none of that. They in fact, worked to suppress all of that while they said the only thing that's going to get us through this is the vaccine, which now that narrative's kind of falling apart a little bit here because remember, they sold it to us. They're like, this solves COVID because we get to herd immunity. And they're like, well, it doesn't do that. Well, this solves it because it stops it from spreading. That didn't do that. Well, this solves it because it's better than a natural immunity or if you've had a prior infection. It turned out to be false. Well, this is our solution because it keeps you out of the hospital. Well, just for a little while, then it wears off and you need boosters. So every part of their whole story has fallen apart at every turn. And that's why I think, you know, the media has a huge, huge mea culpa if they even survive this, because I actually think some of these media companies failed so spectacularly, they really ought not to be entrusted ever again.
Well, they're also going to probably be liable for suits. One thing we had to talk about, what really surprised me is when I had COVID, I had a false oximeter. The battery was going down, so my oxygen levels were going down. I was measuring this when I had COVID. So when they dropped down to 90, my doctor said, my God, you need to get into the ER. I get into the ER. It turned out it was a false reading, but they gave me a blood test, took a look at my lungs, and then they prescribed a Z-Pak or azithromycin. And I asked them to renew my ivermectin. They said, no, we don't do that. And the hospitals don't do that. And we need to talk about some of the conflicts of interest, and you probably know this figure better than I do, but isn't it like they get 13,000 if you're admitted to the hospital for COVID, 39 if you get vented? So there's kind of like a financial incentive not to give you therapeutics.
Well, that's absolutely true. And then there's one other thing we need to talk about, which is this really horrible thing called the PREP Act. Congress passed this thing, they shoved it through, and the language in the PREP Act removes a hospital and any provider all liability for anything that happens as long as they stick to the approved script. So that's whatever the NIH says here, the COVID treatment guidelines. If they stick to that, they could do anything they want. You could have like the worst survival statistics ever. You could be a doctor who had 50% of your COVID patients die, but you're in the clear from a liability standpoint as long as you followed the NIH guidelines. So these are the people who actually created the guidelines. Still to this day, they say, ivermectin, we don't know. We're still waiting for a clinical trial. We're not sure. They never funded one, but they're like, yeah, there's not enough data. They're the people who still say to this day, as of this morning, because I just checked, they're not sure about vitamin D. There's not enough evidence. We have like 30 papers now. It's solid, right? So these are the people who said remdesivir, ventilators, maybe try some dexamethasone, which is a corticosteroid, but at what I consider homeopathic doses, right? 6 milligrams. It's like, no. We should be using methylprednisolone at like 100 milligrams. Right? It should be like this massive thing like the FLCCC doctors worked out in March of 2020, right? So everything that's coming out of the NIH and the CDC and the FDA is actually, when you unpack it, it's not like they are just incompetent, Jim. It's not like they coin flip 50% of the time they got it wrong. 100% of the time, their decisions resulted in poor treatments that resulted in more deaths and more injuries for people. Like, without fail, everything they picked didn't work. And so eventually you go, once is an accident, twice is coincidence, but three times is enemy action. That's what they say in the military. So when I see that they got literally everything wrong that I could see clinically every step of the way, I have to conclude there's something else happening here that's not about the science. It's not about humanity. It's not even about being a good American trying to do the best you can under difficult circumstances. That was like January and February 2020. By March, we should have started to resolve this. By April, this was a solved deal. By May, we knew all about ivermectin. We knew all about hydroxychloroquine as much as we needed to say, these are very safe drugs. They have a signal. We should be using them. And that's been not what happened.
You know what was really surprising, Chris, too? It's not just what the government's doing, what the medical profession and drug companies are doing, but also the pharmacies are refusing to honor the renewal of prescriptions at CVS or Walgreens. So that's something I have never experienced in my entire life.
That actually, if we wanted to have a representation that sort of laid bare just how ugly this is, that's it. Because my background, my PhD from Duke is in a medical science. It's pathology, but my subspecialty was toxicology. So, we study drug effects and all this stuff. And when I looked into the toxicology around ivermectin, Jim, I've never seen a safer compound ever, right? It's just, they've given billions of doses. There's a few things recorded in the drug adverse database, but they couldn't ever say that it wasn't other drugs that people were on or people took it when they were super sick. So sometimes things happen, but it's safer than aspirin on a per dose basis by far, right? So I see that. And all of a sudden you have the pharmacist coming out saying, ethically, we don't think we can fill this prescription because we're worried about, well, what? It's not safety. What are they worried about? That it might work? I don't know what they're worried about. Jim, these are the same pharmacists who handed out OxyContin like candy and killed 100,000 people in the last year, right? These are the same pharmacists who had no ethical concerns about running opioids out into the population. But suddenly, they grew ethics around ivermectin, the safest drug in the entire database that I've ever looked at. It doesn't add up. It just doesn't add up.
You know, the other thing that struck me too, and you probably have better figures on this, Chris, but if we take a look at all the vaccines that have been out there over the last two decades, I think there's maybe 200 deaths. I think right now we're past 16,000 deaths from this vaccine and over 500,000 injuries. I mean, I have two family members. One sister got the vaccine, was in the hospital the next day with blood clots. Now she has myocarditis. The other sister has AFib. So why aren't we talking about that?
Well, this is probably one of the largest campaigns. This is going to go down in history, Jim. What we're talking about here is the largest failure in our medical intervention history. So listen, the vaccines can make sense under some circumstances, certain risk profiles. We had to rush them out, but there's no excuse for what hasn't happened in the past 18 months once we've learned about what's really going on here. That what you're talking about, those figures of how many people are in the vaccine adverse event reporting system, the VAERS system, estimates are as low as that's a 30-fold undercounting to as high as that's a 100-fold undercounting. So if you said, we think there's 16,000 deaths, if it's 10 times higher than that, it's actually 160,000, right? You and I both know now more people, I know more people who've actually been harmed or killed by the vaccine. This is my personal network. I'm not stretching out across my whole network of people who write into me. Personal network, I know more people who within, you know, X number of hours or days after getting their first or second jab, fell down with atrial fibrillation, had some sort of underlying disease come roaring back out of their condition, or died. And so that's in my personal network. So I think we're actually not that far away from more people going, hey, that's kind of weird. I do know more people who seem to have been impacted negatively by the vaccine itself than from COVID. And so I know some people have a different part of that story. They know more people who got hit by COVID. But in my network, more people have been harmed by the vaccine than by COVID. So that's just my personal anecdote level. What the crime here, Jim, is that we don't actually have any comprehensive way to address that further, because the VAERS system was set up by Congress in the aftermath of the DTP disaster, where they had some bad batches that went out on that vaccine. And they said, let's not do that again. We'll set up a system where if a signal pops out of that noise, we'll see it. But then what's supposed to happen is part two of that is you go follow that signal. Nobody's following this stuff up. I know, because people write into me about this, several hundred examples now of people who said, I was vaccine injured, I had myocarditis, I had this, I had that. Nobody's called me. Nobody's interested. Nobody from the FDA, nobody from the CDC, nobody from the hospital is at all even slightly interested in hearing their story. And so that tells me what's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, I've known people, I've had clients die of the vaccine. I've had family members that have been injured from it. My brother's son's baseball coach got the vax. Guy was a gym rat. Died two days later of a heart attack. So you're hearing more and more about this. And one of the things that we've seen here, and you interviewed Robert Kennedy Jr. in his new book, The Real Fauci. And the one thing that struck me is in 1 year, Chris, and this is something that people don't see in the larger picture, in 1 year, they got rid of most of the Bill of Rights with what these politicians are doing. I mean, you think about it, when they shut down the business, and I never understood this, and this made me skeptical, but when they first began to shut down the economy, I could go to Costco, I could go to Target, I could go to Walmart, I wouldn't get COVID, but I would get COVID if I went to the local gym or the local restaurant. Now, make sense out of that.
I can't, and I just had an interview with a guy who helps me make sense of that, is a guy named Matthias Desmet. He's a Belgian psychologist who talks about mass formation is the technical term, mass psychosis. Maybe you've heard about it, or people think about Germany, 1933 to 1944. There's periods of time, like the Salem witch trials, when humans go a little nuts. We do some dumb stuff. And he said there's some conditions that you need to have in order for that to occur. And one of those conditions is called the loss of sense making. And it's actually a program that psychologists know how to work, where if you can confuse people enough, you can get them to do things. And in the UK, they call them nudge units. They also call them nudge units in Australia. They're operating here too, but they're not quite as publicly visible. And their job is specifically to advance a government agenda by confusing you. So you just mentioned to think of something that's very nonsense. It's your loss of sensibility or sense-making is a part of that. So it's like, wait a minute, hold on. You're telling me that if I walk into a restaurant, I have to have my mask on because COVID when I'm walking, but when I sit down, I can take the mask off, right? And we all agree, oh yeah, that's what you do. That's how it is. COVID doesn't work when you're sitting, right? It's nonsense, obviously. Hey, the corner hardware store, that can't stay open because COVID could transmit there, but Home Depot can stay open, right? That's nonsense. So that it's actually part of the program to put nonsensical things out there. So for example, you go to Sweden, you go to their National Health Ministry, you go to their website, they got some FAQs on there. And one of them is, hey, do kids have to wear masks in school? And they say, no, here's the science. Masks don't make any sense for kids. There's no recorded instances of kids passing it. They're really poor transmitters of this stuff. They're really not actually all that impacted by COVID in the first place. And by the way, masks retard childhood development at a critical age when children are trying to learn how to read facial structures, which is subtle and complex. So on balance, no, masks don't make any sense. So that's sense making. Over here, I just saw a picture where all this governor of the state of New York is smiling and she's standing under the big row of adults who are all in the health side and they're all maskless. And in front of them is a little row of masked up kids, right? And you go, well, that's weird. It's not just weird, Jim. The point is that this is nonsense because when you have nonsensical stuff like that, we can't make sense of it. But when the dust settles, you say, but wait a minute, we lost all our civil liberties. We lost all these small and medium-sized enterprises. All these big corporations made out like bandits. More power was concentrated in the hands of state and local officials and government officials. And when the dust settles, you find out, again, three times as enemy action, every single one of these things made it so that small and medium-sized enterprises and individuals lost, and big corporations and their political guardians won. That's the story we have today.
Oh, it's amazing because if you go through Build Back Better, I called it Build Back Worse or Why Not Put It Back Together. But if you take a look at some of the tax provisions against small business, it's not like, you know, what we've done to small business closing. I mean, my favorite Italian restaurant for three decades, we've been going, they went under with the shutdowns. I mean, it's kind of sad that you put hundreds of thousands of businesses out of business and millions of people out of work, and they're calling this science. I'm so tired of hearing, you know, when people hear science, oh, well, I guess this is what we need to do because it's science. When in reality, Chris, as you and I have just been discussing here, it isn't science. It's political science.
It's even, I'll go one step further. I think it's religious science. It's scientism. It's you have to have this faith in the infallible Fauci and the holy shot or you're a bad person, you know, and it's just like, oh my, it's not science anymore. It clearly isn't. And here's what I'm worried about deepest down is that I understand why some people want to use nudge units and, you know, create this. And I understand human incentives and I understand why people want more money and power and ego and greed. And I get that. The thing that's at risk here for me, Jim, is that the engine of prosperity in our country has always been built on the idea that we have this broad and stable middle class and upper middle class, and these are the true engines of prosperity. And now we're heading toward this area where they want to control all of that, and, you know, shut it down and give people universal basic income under this really dumb idea that somehow we'll still have the same amount of prosperity that they get to sort of parasite onto and extract wealth from. It's the classic killing the golden goose story. I care a lot because if we go down this path all the way, it ends badly. You know, when you get into a mass psychosis event, the chance of that ending in mass atrocities is very high. And whether we measure those mass atrocities by people in a ditch, which we see the old pictures of, or it's just people locked away, Jim, until they give up. And they play video games and they drink themselves to death or they die of fentanyl overdoses or they just lost their dreams. That's another form of atrocity. That's where we're going. And I think we ought to be it's really time to call it what it is. There are people who are taking this country in a path that I think is ruining it, and I'm not okay with that.
No, I mean, you can see it in Australia where they have quarantine internment camps. In fact, one of the big news stories in Australia was two non-vax quarantine people in the camp escaped. And it was like, you know, the news was presenting it like we got two serial killers on the loose. You know, two unvaxxed people escaped the quarantine camp. I want to talk about some other things that I think also is contributing to this, and that's the role of media, social media, and the mob. And what media has done, they're divisive. They basically turn Americans against each other, you know, the vax against the unvaxxed. And the role that we've seen with the big tech companies, this has blown my mind more than anything else, because we have this great technology called the internet. I mean, look at you and I are doing this interview. I'm doing it from my library. You're doing it from your home. We have this technology that's great. But did you ever believe you would see the big tech companies censoring, you know, the president of the United States or doctors trying to get information out to the people, and they censor them?
This has been astonishing to me because, yeah, no, I consider the big tech companies are way too powerful. We've known that for a long time. They have full monopolistic control over things. They ought to have fallen under the Sherman Act or something else a long time ago. But what they've done has been nothing short of highly, highly, highly damaging. I'm at the point now, Jim, where if somebody said, hey, we think there ought to be trials and some of these people ought to be put on trial, I'd be like, hell yeah, let's do that. Because what they've done... So, you know, I work with the frontline COVID critical care doctors, right? So that's Paul Merrick and Pierre Corey. And I work with people like Peter McCullough. And I see how these people who have life-saving information, who are at the top of their field, have been branded somehow medical disinformation. We don't know by who. Could have been some 28-year-old in a cubicle working for Google, right? Who, got their art degree, if they have one at all, you know, making that decision. And those decisions have actually cost lives. And I think there really ought to be consequences for that. And so there's that part of it. But the other part is by working their little magic on people. And I don't know how, Jim, honestly, anymore. I don't trust how many people I see on Twitter are actually people. And they aren't bots that are there designed to sort of nudge impressions. But when I start reading what are allegedly people saying, you know what? I think unvaccinated people ought to be excluded from the hospitals. If they want to die, fine, right? I'm like, whoa. This othering program where they've taken the unvaccinated and they've tried to pin all the ills of the world on them, right? That's bad, because the first step in an atrocity pathway is you have to dehumanize the other. You have to make your problems in the world be about this other awful human being, which isn't a human at the end. They're just the great unwashed, you know? So at any rate, that's a bad program. I think somebody needs to be held to account for that, because one does not simply create those categories of otherness to the point where you see people wishing harm, if not death, on those other people. That's a path that ends in civil war or worse, right? It goes down that path. And let's not do that, because if we want to assign actual cause and effect, I think we have to back this truck way up, Jim, and we have to talk about where this virus came from. And it came out of a lab. Fauci and his minions funded it. We had the guy, Peter Daszak from EcoHealth Alliance, running this stuff. We have all the data. We have the grants. We understand they were taking bat viruses and merging them with other coronaviruses, and they were attempting to make them more infective towards humans, and they were putting in things like that little furin cleavage site to make it even more transmissive. They were doing gain-of-function research in the place where this thing arose with a lineage coronavirus that we can't trace back to anything natural. So let's talk about where real cause and effect and who's responsible for this. Maybe we should start there rather than say, hey, it's that guy who had a bad anaphylactic reaction to the first jab, so he can't get the second one without literally risking death. Maybe he's not the problem in this story. Maybe it's the people who created this thing in the first place, but the media has done absolutely everything to prevent us from having what I think is a conversation we ought to have, which is who created this thing? Maybe they should have some consequences here.
And also some of the solutions. I call these people Orbots or Orwellian bots or thought police, because, you know, we live in a world today where they've got us to the point where people are afraid to speak out because you can lose. I mean, people are losing their jobs because they're not getting the vax, or people say something in a stupor 10, 15 years ago. Somebody discovers you said this 15 years ago. They fire you. You lose your job. And to me, that is very Orwellian in terms of what they're doing. I call these people Orbots. They're trolls that troll the internet, and they're going after people like Dr. McCullough or some of the others that you mentioned, and trying to discredit them for the job that they're trying to do, which is save people's lives.
Yeah, these Orbots, unfortunately, they're part of the 30% who get caught up in these mass psychosis events. So, you know, it wasn't Germany that went bad in 1933. It was a certain percentage of Germans. And then you got another percentage of people who are kind of like, ah, I don't know how I feel about this, but I'll be quiet. And then you have a smaller percentage, that maybe 10, 15% who speak up and say, ah, this isn't good. Those people, if they don't win that battle early on, those Orbots take over, and you can't let them do that. I mean, that's where we are right now. So I applaud everybody who's stood up and has raised their hand and said, I don't agree with this. Everybody who's been brave, I've taken hits for this. All the doctors I've talked about, many of them have lost their jobs, their positions, they've been sued. Like, the system is working really hard to take these incredibly gifted, incredibly high integrity, caring, compassionate people and turn them into the monsters in this story. And that's where we are. It has nothing to do with the science. By, you know, by the numbers, if I said, hey, Jim, would you rather go to this doctor who's literally treated 3,000 people, hasn't lost one yet, or this other one who's following NIH guidelines, who seems to lose about 6% of his patients? I mean, it's a no-brainer. Like, I'm going with the guy who hasn't lost anybody. Those are the ones who are getting marginalized, and we have to ask for what, by who, and why. And that's why anybody, this is the critical moment. We have to stand together. We have to raise our hands. We have to say, no, I don't agree with this. Not on my watch. Because I gotta tell you, it's not like this magically gets better on its own. The path we're on is a very bad path. Humans have been down it many times. What's good about this social media, the internet, you and I being able to communicate like this thousands of miles apart, we now also, they have great tools to sort of unleash this horror on us. They're using them. We also get to use these tools to find each other and say no, right? It's so much easier today for us to speak like this, reach other people and say, listen, this is serious what's happening right now. Let's not do this. Let's find each other. Let's come together and let's not comply and actually derail this before it goes any further. Because this is not about science anymore. It's not about a disease. It's nothing to do with any of that. It's about something that I'd rather not repeat historically.
Well, I tell you, they're very gifted people. I consider you one of them. And Ray Dalio, in his new book, The Changing World Order, Chris, he says we're at stage 5 on the verge of either civil war or revolution. Now, this is probably one of the smartest and largest hedge fund managers in the world. And he's talking about this. He's talking about the media. He's talking about the loss of control. He's talking about political parties see each other as enemies now rather than competitors. He's talking about the role of media destroying people. And he's talking about inflation. So I want to move on to another topic here, and let's talk about energy. You and I go back to the days when we were looking at peak oil. How do you view peak oil today, given what we've seen with horizontal drilling and shale? I'm still a peak oil believer. I just think it's been pushed further out. What are your views?
Oh, it's peak oil actually is alarming me greatly at this point in time. So the shale drilling and all that, listen, I've visited these drill pads. I know the people who are in the biz. It's amazing technology. I mean, I'm just in awe, like, you know, watching these people drill down 10,000 feet, find a seam of shale that's maybe 100 feet thick, turn the drill sideways, go another 10,000 feet, stay right in the middle of that. It's just brilliant. It's also the retirement party, as Art Berman put it, right? That we're down in the source rocks. And I look at this and I say, we have now drilled through the best, all the tier one stuff. And if you look at where we are in that shale story, and I go all the way down to individual companies, individual wells, individual parts of the plays, we see now even Exxon, you know, just reported that they have about a 13% lower yield this year than last year on their drill projects. So we're drilling into you know, it's not over, but 13% less becomes 20% less, and on and on. That's part one of this story. Part two, we are at the cusp of a global, worldwide energy crisis that's happening right now for a variety of reasons, right? EIA just yesterday announced that the United States has the lowest coal stockpiles in its entire data series, which goes back, I think, you know, 100 years plus, right? So there's not a lot of coal. Europe's in the grip of a major natural gas crisis right now, and that it's very structural. It's going to be hard to fix that. We've just seen the CEO of Halliburton. We've seen the CEO of Saudi Aramco come out and say, hey, world, we kind of had 6 years of underinvestment in oil exploration. We're going to be facing real shortfalls in the future. Now, in Europe, Jim, natural gas is up 400% in the past year in price. You would think, wow, when something goes up 400%, people use less of it, right? Nope. They're using just as much as they did last year. It's a very inelastic compound substance in our life. It is the master resource. So what I'm looking forward in 2022, I'm seeing oil in structural shortfall that there's nothing we can do about, because it takes 4 or 5 years of new investment to get that, you know, turn that super tanker around. We're going to have structural shortfalls combined with massive central bank printing. I think we're going to be facing probably one of the most punishing periods of unstoppable inflation, which is both supply-driven on one side for oil and supply-driven in terms of currency units from central banks. Thanks, Jerome, on the other side. That's what I see coming, and it's really a huge story. Everybody listening needs to look into this, because this is the story that's going to dominate 2022, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'm right there with you. I see an energy crisis, and by mid-decade. And Chris, it's not just the fact that because of these lower prices, energy companies have not made the needed investment. I mean, you know, for our listeners, picture a warehouse. In this warehouse, you have barrels of oil. They go out the front door when they're sold, and we consume them. But that energy company needs to have new barrels coming in through the back door. In order to do that, they have to invest, they have to explore. And then the other thing, Chris, I cannot understand is Wall Street getting on the boards of companies. I can think of Exxon, which you had the small hedge fund manager gets 3 seats, and they want American and large Western oil producers to divest themselves of their oil projects, which really makes OPEC more powerful. Because, I mean, look at Biden. He's going to OPEC and he says, please produce more oil. So a lot of these things we're trying to do, from green mandates, like my own state of California, we're shutting down our second and last final nuclear power plant. We've made laws that if you're a truck driver, you know, we're not going to allow diesel trucks in here in the year 2030. You won't be able to buy gasoline cars by 2035. And we have all these mandates. At the same time, we're shutting down our sources of power and going to wind and solar. I mean, everybody likes wind and solar. It's supposed to be clean. But Chris, I don't see this economy in our electrical grid running on wind and solar.
No, it really can't still at this point. And you know, intermittency is the key word there. And you know, one of the things I keep a very open mind about is, where are we on battery technologies? And you know, every week somebody says, oh, we've discovered something, but it's always at the lab. It's on a bench somewhere and hasn't made it out to production. And so I'm very hopeful there, but hope is not a great strategy when it comes to this, because energy is not negotiable, right? If lumber gets expensive, you know, you don't build the addition this year, right? But if energy runs short, things don't happen in our economy, and that becomes very bad. So I'm watching this, and just look at Europe right now. So Germany made this huge investment. They had their Energiewende, right? This big program. They shut down a lot of coal. They're shutting down nuclear, and they're going to run this all on wind and solar. And just this year, they discovered that's kind of a problem, because they had a couple of periods where both the sun didn't shine and the wind didn't blow. And they're like, oh, now what do we do? Fast forward, and it's so bad that a headline yesterday in Bloomberg said that Sweden is taking an old generating plant out of mothballs, firing it up. Jim, this is an oil-based electricity producing power plant, because if they didn't do that, Poland's grid might go down, and they had to fire this up to ship electricity to Poland, who was in really bad shape. So when we look at that, I think we're going to see that the narrative, remember, we're back to narratives. When you tell yourself a wrong narrative, bad things happen. We've been fed this steady diet of saying electrons that come from wind and solar are vastly preferable and they're great. And all we have to do is just have the political will and look, they're cheaper now than coal. And those are actually really trite stories that vastly oversimplify what is an incredibly complex subject, which is how is energy in total produced, distributed, and consumed within a society. It's not simple. It's not as simple as saying we just put up more wind towers and we can just not use fossil fuels. It's not that simple. And we've done ourselves a disservice by telling that story over and over again. We need a more nuanced story at this point.
Yeah, I'm with you on the peak oil camp that we're getting down to the bottom of the barrel when we get to shale. And I see an energy crisis like you do coming. But Chris, it's not just that we want to make this transition to green, but green takes batteries. It takes raw materials, lithium, nickel, copper. And yet at the same time that we're doing this, we will not allow new mines to go into effect. There's a copper mine in Alaska. There's another mine in Minnesota that's been shut down. So, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to buy these raw materials from other countries but not produce them here? I just don't see how that works.
Well, now we're down to, I think, the nub of this story. So I actually had the pleasure of, I served on this UN sustainability panel for a while. And this gentleman who tapped me for it, who thought I would be a good idea, like I'm the only guy that, like, I'm stood out like a sore thumb, right? There's presidents of major oil companies on this thing. There's, like, you know, World Bank officials on, and me. I'm just some internet guy, right? But this guy had tapped me because of the crash course and my piece on energy economics, thought I could add an outside voice. And I'm very outsider in that story. At any rate, on this was packed with people from China. So I'm having these discussions with people who are really super senior within, as far as I'm concerned, from the Chinese structure. And they understood this story brilliantly. This is like 5 years ago. They got it. They understood that the whole future was about resources and you either had access to them or you didn't. And what the more I talked to them, the more uncomfortable I became, Jim, because they got it. These Chinese people were like very clear-headed, very rational. They said, either you have access to this or you don't. Now the whole Belt and Road concept made a lot of sense to me because they didn't want to compete with the U.S. on a blue water basis, Navy. So they, guess what? If you have a land route to all these resources, you win. And so they saw the next decades all about who has access, who has physical access to the copper, to the cobalt, to the oil fields, to all of that. And that was their whole strategy. And they were very clear-eyed about it. They said, wow, this all stuff is all in short supply and we need it. You need it. Guess what? We're going to make sure we have access to it. In the United States, you talk to people about this and they get kind of glassy-eyed, they get vague, they wave their hands and they talk about market forces as if, you know, you just wave your magic dollars around and you get access to these things. Hey, that can happen. But when push comes to shove, Jim, and it's about resources, it always comes down to this. Do you have access to them or don't you? And China's making sure they have physical access to these things. Makes sense. I get it. I think we're running probably a really dumb strategy here, which kind of got laid bare with the whole shutdown and global stuff. And hopefully people realize that if you either have a mine in your country or you don't, if you don't have the mine in your country, you better have really friendly, good relations with the people who do have that mine in their country. China's out there building those relationships. So one example, the best, most amazing copper mine that isn't yet open, but the last biggest deposit like this that I'm aware of is in Afghanistan. And we just got punted out of there in a really embarrassing way. We didn't make a lot of friends with the Taliban because we were busy telling them they needed women in positions of power and that we didn't like how they dressed and we didn't like their culture and we were bombing them. So they didn't like us all that much. China, as soon as we got booted out of Kabul, China just, you know, doesn't go anywhere. They, you know, open up their arms in their embassy. And they told the Taliban, hey, you guys, you be you. We have no position on that, but we'd really like access to this copper mine over here. And they got it, right? So China's busy making friends using what I would call checkbook diplomacy. We've been busy in the world running what I'd call old thinking, which is gunboat diplomacy. And guess what? One of those things wins more friends. And I honestly think, Jim, we're in for a world of hurt because we're not positioned for even the most basic of resources that we need to operate our economy as we've come to know and love it. That's what this next 10, 20 years is about.
Well, the amazing thing about it, we have a lot of resources. We just are prohibited from using them. So when you don't allow oil drilling in Alaska, you don't allow a copper mine in Alaska or nickel in Minnesota or copper in Arizona, you have resources you're not tapping. And you're basically saying our strategy is to rely on other powers who may not like us.
That is the strategy. I don't think it's a strategy, though. The strategy is over giving it too much credit. It's really short-sighted. And I don't think it's built for what I see coming in the world. But, you know, the most powerful graph I had was the graph which came out from Beijing Petroleum University in China, 2017. They said, oh, we're going to hit a peak of oil production here in China in 2018, which they did. And here's how much oil we're going to have to import. And they could see it clearly going forward. And it's a massive number. And it was just a year after that, China overtook the United States as the world's number one importer. Of course, we were producing more, so that reduced our own need on this. But at this point in time, hands down, no question about it, China is by far the number one importer of oil. And that is what the next 10 years is going to be all about. Because people don't know this, because the narrative, we're Saudi Arabia too. We export oil. It's not actually true. None of that. But we told ourselves that enough times that people do think it's true. It's not. And so, sake of argument, we're producing probably in the vicinity of 12 million barrels just under a day right now. We're consuming 18. And most people don't know that. That's how it is. So at any rate, China actually has access to all that stuff now. And with Afghanistan falling, they get a land route to Tajikistan, which has the world's largest known gas deposits. And so they can put a pipeline straight across that now. They have the largest reserves, and they're making deals with Russia. And Russia is, being marginalized and treated poorly by Europe. And Russia's saying, well, that's fine. This gas has got to be sold to somebody. Why not somebody friendly? I don't understand what the United States, Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand is sort of add-ons to that story. I don't understand what we're up to, because it kind of looks like, I got to be honest, Jim, it looks like if China had a wish list of things that would happen geopolitically, strategically, and from a resource standpoint, that's what's happening to these countries right now. We're taking ourselves out of the game at a critical moment. I don't get it.
And if you talk about power, military power, economic power, it comes from military power feeds off economic power. You got to have the money to buy the ships, the guns, the bullets. And when you take a look at what they're doing, as you mentioned, they're in Africa, they're in Afghanistan, and in all the strategic places for all the key materials that we need for this modern technological society we live in, whether it's oil, natural gas, whether it's copper, rare earth, lithium, nickel, all those things, they get it. We don't.
That's how I see it at this point in time. So I got to tell you, not a lot of people talk about resources and oil, but to me, that's the one lens. If you put that lens on, all this stuff that's happening right now makes sense from that standpoint. Maybe it doesn't explain everything, but man, has a lot of explanatory power in terms of what China's doing and in terms of what's happening here. And I just don't understand why we have people in positions of power in these Western countries who are saying, you know what, let's take our own people, let's lock them in their houses, let's take away their economic opportunity, let's give them a little universal basic income stimmy check now and then to just keep them from rioting or whatever's happening. But I don't understand why anybody thinks that's the correct strategic decision at this stage of things. I don't get it. I'm really at a loss here.
Well, let's move on to another topic that I see unfolding next year. You and I briefly touched upon it, but we've got inflation, and I think the inflation numbers, Chris, and I think you would agree, are much higher than reported. 6.2%, it's probably double that or more. So next year, we've got three things happening, which I think is my next perfect storm. We've got rising energy prices. I could see us hitting 100. We've got rising interest rates and inflation while the Fed is pulling back on the money printing and it's wanting to raise interest rates. I don't think they get that far. And then the third thing is you've got massive taxes. So rising taxes, rising interest rates, rising energy and inflation is a recipe for a recession. I see no way the Fed is going to be able to stop inflation at this point unless they throw the economy into a complete recession?
Well, the recession would be a kind word for it. I think the Fed is terrified. I think that, you know, they made a bad mistake in 2001. They doubled down on it in 2008. They've tripled down on it here. And by the way, you know, the printouts and bailouts and printing that I saw in each of those earlier stages, this whole thing is, I don't know what to make of this, like trillions of dollars of new Fed printing. And they're clearly driven by the quote unquote markets, where the Fed is terrorized of these bubbles bursting. And so they're captive, I think, now to the Frankenstein they created. So the Fed really can't raise rates. If they do at this point in time, raise rates is, they don't actually raise rates. What they do is they withdraw money from the system, and the system has to charge itself more interest to compensate for that over time. So when the Fed's raising rates, they're just withdrawing liquidity from a system that implodes if it doesn't have sufficient liquidity. I think they're trapped at this point. So the Fed's going to do everything it can to pretend like inflation isn't really here, and they've been jawboning it, calling it transitory. Of course, they pad the statistics, them with their BLS friends over there. You know, they hide the true rate of inflation, but eventually people notice, and I've already seen that, right? We know now that people get it. Their groceries cost a lot more, gasoline's obviously more, but more than that, things about house prices, medical services, all kinds of things. And we're starting to see people not go to work when they can't afford it, right? So that they're like, oh my God, there's this huge labor shortage. No, there's a wage shortage. People will work, but they're not going to work at a rate that causes them to actually lose ground. They won't do that. So you have to pay them more. So we're seeing the wage pressure come in, and that's where the Fed is really out of bullets. What are they going to do there? The only thing they can do is raise interest rates. That blows the system up. It just does. So I actually think this is a once in a many, many generations sort of a moment. It could take a few more years to play out. But Jim, this is why if people come to my site, I tell them all this context, and then I say, you probably want to get resilient around this, because this could get really iffy. And so, you know, having the basic ability to attend to your own needs and live in a strong community and to have like-minded people around you who see it this way. And I think we're going to have to roll up our sleeves the Fed could really, I got to be honest, Jim, I don't see how the Fed gets out of this. I mean, do you see a path for them if you could advise them?
No. I mean, basically, you know, there's four things that a government can do to handle debt. One is austerity, which is spending less. We know that's not going to happen, not popular with voters and politicians. Two, we default or restructure, maybe for smaller countries, doesn't work for the U.S. Three, transfers of money and credit from those who have. So hence the surtax of 5 to 8% on people that make a lot of money in the Biden proposal. And four, printing money and devaluing it. I see a major devaluation. I'd like to get your thoughts on this. I see them devaluing the currency as they did in 33 and 71 against gold, Chris, because if the U.S. was to devalue its currency, well, you know, the first thing the Europeans are going to do, they're going to devalue their currency. The Japanese are going to devalue theirs. It becomes a beggar thy neighbor policy. But what if we wake up one day all of a sudden we devalue the dollar against gold and gold's $10,000 an ounce?
It's always a possibility. I don't know what they're planning. I know they must have some plans, right? So we've seen the IMF talk about, you know, new SDR-like sort of creations. We've seen the European Central Bank talking about maybe they need digital currencies and maybe they do that. But whatever way they go, it's very clear once you add it up. And by the way, Bridgewater Associates put out this graph a number of years ago where they added up, like, what are the debts of the United States? But then there's debts plus IOUs. And an IOU in this story is an underfunded pension. It's an underfunded Medicare program. It's a this or that. And so when they added up all of those things, they found out that our underfunding and strict debts added up to 1,100% of GDP, like not payable. The only question to resolve when you look at that picture is who's going to eat the losses, right? So very clearly, Wall Street doesn't like to eat the losses. The banks are trying to make sure it's not them. Politicians don't want it to be them. So that's the only question everybody listening to this has to resolve is who's going to eat the losses. And the only thing I can figure, Jim, at a time of history like this is it's very clear regardless of whether we denominate it a new fancy thing called a Fed coin or a crypto that's operated by the ECB, blah, blah, blah. It's the same old story. People who have the claims, they lose. The people who have the real assets, they don't lose as much or they even win. So I think this is a period of time where you've just got to be in really tangible, hard assets, at least as a defensive sort of an insurance policy sort of basis. But for me, that's whenever I have the chance now, I'm buying land, land with trees on it. I'm buying gold, I'm buying silver, I'm improving the soil around my property. I'm like things. I think we're back to that part of the story, which is as old as currency printing or coin clipping has been around.
You know, that's amazing because Ray Dalio in his book says it's time for real assets. I mean, the land is still there. The gold is still there. I can see gold and silver exploding because, I mean, I live in California, Chris. Prices are up 16% year over year. Our definition of a millionaire is now a homeowner. I mean, I've seen tract homes, Chris, and I'm talking about 2,500 square foot homes on a small postage stamp lot that are going for well over $1 million. And this is San Diego. You go further north up the coast in Orange County, Irvine, Los Angeles, San Francisco. They're just crazy in terms of the prices. I mean, you're talking, Bill Gates just bought a little over a 5,000 square foot house on the water in Del Mar. It used to be a part of T. Boone Pickens' estate. He paid like $48 million for it. I'm talking about a 5,500 square foot house.
Wow. Yeah, that's inflation. And of course, to hearken back to what the BLS might do with that, they wouldn't measure that in the same way you would. According to the BLS, you know, owner's equivalent rent is up like 4% over last year. I'm like, nah, not if you actually wanted to own a house. That's a different story, right? So yeah, there's just games played on that. And according to the BLS, cars cost the same today as they did in 1998. They've gone up zero. And of course, they justify that by saying, well, you know, they have side airbags now and they last longer, which is true, the higher quality. But the idea that a car, which an average car in 1998 was $17,000 and today it's $36,000, to say those are the same price is ridiculous.
Yeah, the use of hedonics. I want to talk about something that you mentioned in your crash course. And by the way, at the end, I want you to give out your website. You owe it to yourself to read Chris's crash course, one of the best pieces of information you could do to protect yourself and understand what's going on. But let's talk about preparedness. And one of the things I've done, Chris, in California, because they're always jacking up our utilities, we have brownouts. I have a solar-powered house. I've had to add more solar panels because they changed the way they price electricity now, but now I'm going to have to get Tesla batteries as a backup because of the brownouts. And what really concerns me living here is once they shut down the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, we're going to lose another 10%. The irony of this, Chris, we're buying excess energy from Arizona from their two nuclear power plants as we're shutting down our two plants. You can't rationalize this thought. But also something that I came across when we first did the shutdown, when people, and explain this, this gets back to your mob psychology thing, when you could get toilet paper, but we also couldn't get eggs. You know, Costco was limiting you to the amount of meat or chicken you could get. So, you know, I have a 6-month food supply now. And I'm also thinking of developing part of our property and growing some of my own crops and food. I mean, just like Americans did with the Victory Garden during World War II. So let's talk about how listeners, given the information we've been talking about here, can prepare for themselves.
Well, thank you. This is near and dear to my heart, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm walking the talk. So right now, my property that I have with my fiance here in Massachusetts, we got a couple hundred acres. We're fortunate to have really nice land, and we're working on, got a nice garden, and we put in fruit trees, and we got some cows out there helping to repair some soils and build those back up. And all of this is actually really, really important. So to me, resilience is having the ability to grow some of your own food. Not all of it. I'm not saying we all become subsistence farmers again, not even close. But if push ever came to shove and either food became unavailable or really, really expensive, it's so much easier to go from growing, say, 3% of our food to growing something more than that, right? So gives you options. And as well as I think you know probably better than anybody and your listeners, the food that we do get now in many cases is really devoid of nutrient value and low quality and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of reasons to push down this direction, but I do believe people ought to be as resilient as possible. And that begins with having some stored food, the ability to filter some water if you ever had to, so having some of those on hand, the ability increasingly because of the social unrest we're seeing to defend yourself because, you know, when seconds count, the police are only minutes away, you know, and that's increasingly, you know, part of the story for people. And it's a measure of just, I think, being what my great-grandfather and everybody prior to him would have recognized as normal, which is you should be responsible for some of your own physical well-being in this story. And I do it not just as a matter of thinking, oh, I'll survive. I do it because I want to be a contributing member of my community. I do it because I want to be in a position to be helpful if or when that's necessary. I do it because it feels responsible. And I also do it because, you know what, Jim, it feels good. I like being sort of somewhat in control of my own circumstances. And I got to tell you, my trust in, like for you, like your trust in the regulators, whoever's running the electrical grid, making the decision to shut down the nuclear plant, I imagine your trust is a little low that they're going to get this right or that they have the right story or that they aren't running some woke platform that has its own agenda, which isn't necessarily making sure your power doesn't go out, right? So I think that loss of trust, that loss of faith, the so-called fourth turning loss of faith in our institutions, the only way I know to make that feel better in myself is to make sure that what those institutions used to be providing for me, I can provide for myself at least in part. And so that's what resilience is about. It's really just stepping up to the times and saying, what do I need to do to make sure that I'm taking care of me, my loved ones, and a positive value to my overall community?
Chris, as we begin to close here, tell our listeners about your crash course, which I'm going to recommend anybody listening. If you haven't gone through Chris's crash course, you're really missing out on something that could really be helpful to you and your well-being financially as well as personally.
Well, sure. Thanks, Jim. Yeah. The crash course is my best view of taking a systems level look at the world. And it looks at the economy, energy, and environment sort of at a high enough level to say, God, if we look at all these things together, it gives us a way of looking at the world. So it becomes a way of seeing what's happening. I think it both explains what's happening and it's got some predictions, you know, it sort of explains where we might be going as a consequence. So the crash course is in book form. You get it on Amazon. It's also in video form for people who like things that way, and individual chapters, all of which can be found at Peak Prosperity, P-E-A-K, prosperity.com. That's my website. We got a great community there. We've got a subscription service for people who want to go deeper on these things. We've got a lot of free information there. So I'm there. But you know what's best there, Jim? The community. We got a lot of people who are all wrestling with these same sorts of things we've been talking about. So that's what we do. And, you know, of course, you can find all my stuff at YouTube or at Twitter, again, using my name.
And one final book that you've written with Adam Taggart, Prosper. Tell our listeners about it.
Sure. So Crash Course, Jim, is kind of problem definition. And then Prosper is solution space. What do we do about that? So we break down building resilience across 8 different forms of capital. It helps to have financial capital. We all understand that one. But we also talk about the importance of social capital or living capital. And so there are 8 different forms of capital that we break down, and it becomes a way of thinking about if you were going to take some next steps, where would you apply those next efforts? Which form of capital are you already rich in? Which ones could you maybe do some more building in? And so that's how we approach resilience is in that format. So the book is Prosper with an exclamation point.
And I'm also going to recommend some of the things you've done, extensive research and background on COVID. I think now I've read about 8 books on COVID, and it's just amazing all the misinformation out there. So at least you can get some true facts or at least another perspective that you're not hearing in the evening news. Chris, I want to thank you for being so generous of your time. I've been looking forward to doing this interview with you, and it's good to reconnect again. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Well, likewise, and thank you for the opportunity, Jim. It's been a real pleasure, and I too was very much looking forward to it and very excited to have done this with you.
All right. Well, all the best and happy holidays.
Likewise, happy holidays.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.